Peter Brook is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at his home at 8 Barrett's Mill Road on October 22, 1994. Mr. Brook is 65 years old. At the time when the world's first man-made satellite, Sputnik, was launched by the Soviets in 1957, this area had a very unique potential in terms of the interaction between academia, government, and industry. But the very innovative research and creative entrepreneurial abilities that existed needed the investment capital to convert them into businesses. You certainly were a pioneer at the time, aggressively investing in companies in your capacity as loan officer at the Bank of Boston.
Well, actually, Renee, I was not investing. We're talking now about the period 1958 into the mid-60s. I was not investing in companies. I was lending money from the First National Bank of Boston to these emerging companies that were technologically based. Most of these companies were spin-offs from MIT and Harvard. The most famous department at MIT at that time was the Instrumentation Lab, Stark Draper's lab, and he had any number of assistant professors and professors spun out of the laboratory to do individual contracting work for the U.S. government. And most of that contracting work was to close the technological gap between the United States and Russia. And these small spin-offs dominated Cambridge. You could go in back of MIT and whatever those streets' names were, A Street, B Street, C Street, and garage after garage would be filled with assistant professors and some of their doctoral students doing contract research under their own name for the federal government. This was allowed by MIT at that time. It's not allowed now, but those small spin-outs were financed initially by loans. The department that I started at the First National Bank of Boston High Technology Lending Group lent those small companies funds. We secured the loans by taking the contracts as collateral, the contracts between the Bureau of Ships or the Air Force or whatever it might be as collateral, made our loans against them. When the contracts were done, the work completed, the loan would be repaid and the company would then go on to the next contract. I didn't start to invest in these companies until in 1961, I went to Bessemer Securities and became the head of their venture capital.
It's in New York City.
It was in 61. And at that time, I thought investing in the companies would, as a permanent investor, would be considerably more rewarding than simply lending the money and for contract research.
This is certainly an exciting era in your career that you're relating here. Can you describe that the time of the late 50s, early 60s, as far as the energy, the excitement?
Well you know, I was young, I still have a lot of energy, I guess, but then I was just infused with the excitement of the formation of these new businesses. You've got to remember that when I got out of graduate school, Harvard Business School in 1954, New England was in awful shape. I mean, the textile and the shoe industry had left Massachusetts. We had an unemployment rate in 1958 of something like 13%. This was a very, very depressed area. And it depressed everybody, not just those who weren't out of work, but those who had to live here. It was not a very happy time. When this contract research came as a result of Sputnik into the area, there was a burst of energy. And, you know, if you're young and want to do something important, there was a great opportunity for a lot of people to move ahead. And so rather than the depression that we had in the middle 50s, we had this surge of economic growth in the 60s, and everybody's spirit rose. So it was a happy, and exciting time. And of course, we did close the technological gap between Russia and America because of the technology that came out of MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and Caltech, and Berkeley. Of technology, it was the conversion of science to technology to useful product for an application to accomplish a specific thing, which was to narrow the technological gap.
As a result, a unique happening in the area that we now know as 128 resulted.
So yeah, it really the first area of expansion was all that territory behind MIT, and then the road became important. It was a sign of success when you moved away from MIT onto Route 128. And, you know, Bear Hill was one of the first developments, and there were a lot of small companies in Waltham that sprung up around Bear Hill. And, you know, and then the Waltham Watchworks were filled with Maynard Mills, Digital, and, you know, all these companies filled up a lot of old industrial space that had formerly been textile space. And new companies, of course, were built along the road.
Can you tell what made you stand out in terms of being the one who took the initiative often to know the potential of these companies and believe in them?
Well, there wasn't any stroke of genius. It's, the fact is that the banks at that time were doing the same kind of thing that they did for generation after generation. They were financing old and established businesses, and they were not looking for tomorrow's business. There was only one thing that differentiated this area from any other area around the country, and that was the brain power we had. It seemed to me that that comparative advantage we had over others would eventually differentiate this area from other regions of the country, and that it would behoove the banks to finance the growth of knowledge-based industry. And I didn't think that was particularly a radical thought, but it was radical for a bank, evidently. But I fought that policy through the First National Bank of Boston, and it was accepted. But I never considered it being radical. It was just logical. I mean, you finance in an area what would give you a comparative advantage over others, and what we had were brains. And so it seemed logical to find a way to finance those brains.
But it seemed, because of your infusion, that you were really cornering a market here.
Oh, I did that. There's no question I did that. It was funny. The policy paper I put to the management of the bank is that we would allocate a rather modest amount of lendable funds to finance these knowledge-based industries, that we would try to capture the market, sort out those companies after we had captured that market that we thought really had potential, and let the other banks have what we discarded. So we did develop the best group of companies that came out of this region. And it was a dedicated, and it was a policy decision that we to get these companies in the fold, we loaned them more money at a lower rate than any other bank, and that got us the business. We kept what we wanted, and we let go what we didn't want a year or 2 years hence, and we ended up with a very high quality portfolio. That was a dedicated policy that the bank stuck through for about 10 to 15 years, and it won them all this business.
What were some of the companies that you made possible?
Well, the ones that the one I was identified most with was Wang Laboratories, and I did finance that company in 1959 in Cambridge when it was right behind MIT in a little tiny lot. And I financed it on its way out to Natick. It was in the Natick Industrial Park, and then when it opened in Tewksbury on Route 495.
And continuing your support of Wang when it moved along Route 3 to Lowell.
Damon Engineering was another one which was in the clinical testing laboratories, a very successful company. Unitrode, which is the only semiconductor company still left in Massachusetts, has gone through a reorganization, but I was an investor in that company in 1961 and went on its board in 61 and been on its board ever since. That's a long time to be on. But what is it, 33 years? Yeah, it's a long time. But those were three, and there were many others. There were many others, but those are the ones that I still remain with. Actually, a company I financed out in Groton that has grown to be a very large company called New England Business Service. I don't know if you've ever run into that. It's a mail-order house out in Groton.
The Bank of Boston certainly turned out to be the golden rainbow for the high-tech industry in this area. You have been quoted as saying that bank had more to do with the development of the high-tech industry here than any other capital source. At what point do you move from loans to really launching into venture capital?
That's when I joined Bessemer Securities in 61. That's mm-hmm. when I became an investor and a director. The bank, you see, when the bank, you lent the money and the loans were paid back and you were a third-party provider of debt capital to a business. It wasn't until I got to Bessemer that I was an owner, part owner of those businesses, and went on the board of directors to help in the building of those small enterprises. So I started in 61, and I've been doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that was the time.
And then you went to do investment loans for Tucker Anthony.
Well, I never moved to New York. You know, mm-hmm. My wife came from this area, and we really wanted to live in Concord. I mean, we wanted to bring our children up. Actually, my son Peter was born in 1961, and in May of 61, and June of 61, and we were starting to build our house down at Lindsay Pond Road, and In June of 61, I told my wife that I was taking a job in New York. That was not a happy announcement. But I never moved to New York. I commuted every week, always with the idea that they were going to move down. I never could make the move.
We're certainly all glad that you decided to reinvent yourself, so to speak, coming back to Boston to establish an investment banking business for the brokerage firm of Tucker Anthony. Can you also take us now to, I guess, a more advanced stage of venture capital, where you truly are worldwide.
Well, my firm, TA Associates, which began in 1967, became the dominant, one of the dominant, if not the dominant, venture capital operation in the United States, with a handful of others. It was an industry leader. I always had an international perspective and always thought that we could replicate with TA Associates and what we had done here in other parts of the world. I started investigating the possibility of doing that in 1971 and 72. Arthur D. Little was given a contract by the French Ministry of Industry called the Route 128 contract, which was to investigate what forces created technological development around Route 128. That was the purpose of the study. And Arthur D. Little subcontracted to me the section on venture capital and the role venture capital played in the development of these high technology enterprises. Through that contract, I got to know the Minister of Industry in France and his deputy. And the study proved that venture capital did have a very vital role in the building of these enterprises. And a venture capital industry was encouraged by the French government in 1972. I became a director of that venture capital company called Sofinnova. TA Associates became an advisor to the management of that company. I opened an office in Paris, and we were at that time giving advice to not only to Sofinnova, but to the government as well. And from that base, we consulted to the Deutsche Bank in Germany and to the Swedish Development Bank and others who were interested in venture capital as a developmental tool. So it gave me exposure then, and gave me a chance to get to know what people were or were not doing in technology investing in Europe. In the 70s. Now, the conditions were not right for the beginning of venture capital operations in Europe. It was a very stagnant period where there was a move towards socialism and nationalization of industries. There was a common perception that the individual himself had very little to do with technological advancement, that the organizations would do it, whether they be privately owned or governmentally owned. And the idea that the individual could really invent something of significance never occurred to
very different the attitude than this than country. Here.
It didn't, and it wasn't until late in the late 70s, 79, that the bankruptcy of their ideas became apparent. The technological gap between the U.S. and Europe had widened, between Japan and Europe had widened. And you remember that the accepted wisdom was is to prop up employment that was redundant. The French were maintaining a steel industry that was not competitive on a world basis and employing hundreds and thousands of people doing it. Well, after a while, it became obvious that wasn't necessarily the right way to spend the taxpayers' dollars. So a sea change of attitude occurred in the late 70s. The introduction of Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain and the idea of privatization rather than nationalization took place. That created a whole different attitude towards venture capital and the idea that the financing of small enterprise, technology-based small enterprise, couldn't affect be successful. With that change in attitude, we were in a position to replicate TA Associates, first in Britain and then throughout Europe.
Now, you also have something called Advent International.
Well, what happened, this is kind of interesting, TA Associates was very, very successful and is a domestic venture capital company. I started these replicas of TA Associates in every European country and along the Pacific Rim and all the way from Japan to Australia. And those affiliates grew in number and in complexity, and it was obvious that I couldn't manage all of that business inside of TA Associates. So what we did was to spin the international business out of TA Associates into a separate company called Advent International Corporation. Advent International Corporation now is the one that runs the non-U.S. Side of the business. We do U.S. investing as well, but the fact is it's an independent company whose main activity is to provide investment opportunities on a global basis to investing institutions. It's grown from nothing in 1985 now to manage $1.5 billion of assets in 25 locations around the world. So
it's wonderful.
Yes, it's been a lot of fun.
Within this country, in around 1978, certainly the late 70s, a lot of companies went public. How did that affect what you were doing?
Well, that, you know, going back a little bit, in 1971, Associates became the manager of a venture capital program. That was followed by another venture capital program in 1972. We worked for 10 years to 11 years before any substantial gains were realized. It wasn't until the late 70s, the period that you asked me a question about, that public offerings of these technology-based companies became prevalent. I mean, up to that time, there was no public market. We were talking now about the 70s. We're talking about the end of the Vietnam period. We're talking about Watergate, inflation, recession, Watergate. We're talking about probably the worst period for anyone to be in business. It was just depressing for everyone to come home. You know, it was not a brilliant period. We came out of that trough in the late 70s, not just emotionally, but the stock market as well. Well, one's really a mirror of the other. I mean, if people are positive about their lives, they're positive about stocks. I mean, it's you know, it's just the way things go. At the end of the 70s, we shook off the lethargy that was of Vietnam and started to get back and this resurgence of the stock market at the end of the 70s allowed us to take these companies that we had invested in public and to make substantial gains. Now, through the 70s, we were working on our portfolio companies, adding value to them, but that value wasn't reflected in higher prices. It wasn't until the late 70s when the stock market kicked in that we realized these gains, and the gains were substantial. So that very active period, the stock market period in 79, 80, and 81, allowed our investors to cash out quite handsomely. And that sustained the venture capital industry into the 80s and through the 80s.
And then what would you attribute the decline in the economy here to?
A decline now?
As you're getting to the very end of the 80s?
Well, you know, there are two things that impact the economic environment here. One is defense spending, and the other is technological move away from the markets that we dominated. You've got to remember that the 70s, late 70s, and the 80s was the era of the mainframe computer. and the mini computer, and this was the center of the mini computer. The leaders of industry, the Wangs, the Ken Olsons, who the Ed DeCastros at Data General, never really realized what the personal computer could do, what the PC could, that it could be used as a powerful workstation. The reason that they didn't realize that is that this had never been the center of semiconductor research. When we lost the semiconductor technology to California in the 60s and the 70s, it was the most egregious loss, worse than the textile industry, worse than anything else. Because that, the technological, the knowledge of what the semiconductor could do as a device, and its application has allowed California to first catch up and to pass us as a technology center. We never realized in the 80s here what the semiconductor could do. We never realized that it would be that chip would allow the personal computer to become a workstation that could compute to the extent that it has now. Now that advance obsoleted virtually everything that's been done, was done in the mini computer area in the 80s, and has led to the downsizing, led to the bankruptcy of Wang Laboratories and the downsizing of Data General and Digital Equipment. And then you add that to the conversion from away from defense to industry, and that conversion will take a long period of time. You've got a recession that will be with us for a long time. Now, it's not a recession in the way the numbers work out, because there are pockets of unemployment in this state that will not recover in this generation. Like a Lowell and other parts of the state where the mini computer and defense industry was. There's depression in those areas, recession, depression in those areas. But there's a tremendous amount of growth in the computer software, where computer software is done. There's been a great growth in financial services. So the figures overall give us an unemployment rate that's within the state that's acceptable. But there's a great variety of experiences between some locales and others. Overall, the figures look pretty good, but there's still the devastation in Lowell.
Some observers would see this as a natural evolution in the economy. Do you agree?
We're going through the natural evolution. You know, it's and we've got to adjust to it. What bothers me a tremendous amount is in this political rhetoric that we're in an election period now, and the rhetoric that is going around.
Political rhetoric, of course, will always go a counter to businesses naturally evolving without a quick fix.
There is evolution. You know, evolution is a part of life. You evolve, I evolve, the business evolves. Business is a biological thing. It's made up out of people who get together and do things. If they do things productively and change with a period of time, they will be in business for a long period of time. If they don't make those very difficult adjustments, they won't be in business. Divisions of companies have to be downsized. Divisions of a company have to be closed so that the resources can be put into productive sectors that then will grow in the future. That's evolution. And to deny that is a basic failing, and unfortunately it's surfacing in this election.
Thank you. You've certainly made a tremendous impact both locally and globally. We are very glad that you made the decision to remain living in Concord.